Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
But first, we're going to turn to North Korea.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
That was, of course, President Donald Trump last week threatening North Korea after suggestions the communist country is capable of striking the U.S. with a nuclear missile. The president's warning was then followed by a statement from North Korea which said it was carefully examining plans for a missile strike on the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam. Now, today, the North Koreans have backed off that, even as they continue to be fairly bellicose towards the United States. The Trump administration considers North Korea to be America's greatest national security threat, and tensions have steadily escalated this year. We want to hear your questions about North Korea, their goals, how the world and how the Trump administration are reacting. You can join the conversation by calling 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. That's 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also email us at talk@nprnews.org. Joining us today is Sheila Smith. She is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning, Ewan. How are you?
Very well. And yourself?
Very fine, actually. Things are a little bit quieter today.
Yes, yes. Well, one of our past guests, David Kong from the University of Southern California, said at the beginning of July that he believed the situation in the North Korean peninsula is actually more stable than it looks. Basically, his argument was that both sides are engaging in threats and demonstrations of power to keep the other side from attacking. Do you agree with that? I mean, is the situation more stable than it looks?
So there's I think the underlying structure of the situation is exactly as David Kang suggested. We've long had a division of the peninsula. We've long had forces looking across the DMZ, the demilitarized zone, at each other, and from north and south. But I think there's several elements that are somewhat more fluid today than in the past, and we should push past the rhetoric of the past week, I think, to remind ourselves of them. The first is obviously that the North Koreans have begun this path of pursuing a nuclear arsenal and the missile capability to deliver them across continents, right? So this is a fairly significant difference from the underlying structure of the peninsula to date. The second thing is we have a leader in the North, Kim Jong-un, who's young, who's the third Kim in his family to lead the country, who has to think about legitimacy, right, in ways that his father and his grandfather did not, and who has a penchant for violence, frankly, beyond the repressive violence of his grandfather and his father. So we've watched him assassinate his family members. We've watched him assassinate, I think, five, maybe six ministers of defense, head of his military. This is a young leader, perhaps insecure, we don't know, but certainly somebody who doesn't hesitate at all to use violence. And I think those two factors, the nuclearization of the North and Kim Jong-un himself, make it a little bit more We need to be a little bit more careful in our analysis. We can't just fall back on the assumption that there is this stalemate or steady state across the DMZ.
You know, a cynic might argue that these are, in Kim Jong-un and President Trump, we have two leaders who are in a dispute which both are really using to bolster themselves really more for a domestic audience than perhaps, although obviously there's a great impact on the international audience. I mean, do you think there's any validity to that argument?
I think there is, and again, it's more complex than just one, you know, one explanation here. But clearly, both Kim Jong-un and President Trump see themselves as somebody who has to portray themselves as strong leaders, as willing to use force, as willing to stand up and not be bullied. And so the language that what was so surprising about President Trump's language last week, right, the fire and fury, and the next day the locked and loaded, it's a more colorful rhetorical language than we're used to seeing out of U.S. presidents, frankly, especially when it comes to issues related to nuclear war. You know, the United States has been the military superpower and has, you know, developed a nuclear arsenal of its own since the end of World War II. And it tends to advocate for stability, not for, you know, reckless kind of brinksmanship. So I think there is a little bit here that we have to think about the domestic politics on both sides. But the reality is, rhetoric does matter when you come to a situation where there's been provocations on the ground. And Kim Jong-un, before he came into power and then after he came into power, has been much more willing to poke at South Korea a little bit. You've seen mishaps in the maritime region, the sinking of a South Korean naval vessel, shelling of a civilian island. And that was before he came into power. And since he's come into power, he's been quite belligerent in the way he's used his missile arsenal and has shot just this year 14 missiles into Japan's exclusive economic zone. So he's no longer confining himself to the peninsula. So I think there is, you know, domestic politics always matter, I think, in these things, especially when you see two leaders competing rhetorically like this. But there's also been evidence of the use of force in and around the Korean Peninsula that is unusual, and we have to take that seriously.
I'd like to ask you about kind of the effect of this bluster on the international scene, though, because ultimately this is diplomatic. These are diplomatic exchanges, even as they are filled with fire and fury. And that this is a big change from the way that these situations have been handled in the past. And while they may not necessarily mean to follow through, there does seem to be an inherent danger of raising the temperature this way.
I mean, brinksmanship, that's how we've always characterized North Korea, right? Whether it's this Kim or his father, right? That they are experts at brinksmanship. They like to provoke and bring us right to the edge of where we think we may be headed for the use of force or a war, and then they walk back. We're not used to seeing the United States use that kind of approach, and I think that's made many countries very uneasy, both our allies and those who are not our allies necessarily. So China and Russia, for example, have been very nervous about the way that the Trump administration has been handling this, and they saw the potential for a use of force, I think, much earlier in this process. Japan and South Korea, our allies in the region, are slightly different. So Japan has now come under the range of North Korean missiles. And again, they don't have to be nuclear tipped. There's weapons of mass destruction in the North Korean arsenal, chemical and biological weapons, the kind of nerve agents, for example, that Kim Jong-un apparently ordered used against his half-brother in Malaysia just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So there are other kinds of weapons that they could put on a shorter-range missile and wreak terrible damage to the Japanese, right? And so the Prime Minister Abe and his government have really advocated for the United States to maintain a strong position of pressure on the North, that this is not the time for negotiations. South Korea, in contrast, now has a president who campaigned, who was just elected on May 9th, right? We have a new government in South Korea. And he campaigned on the premise that he would open talks to the North. He is from the progressive left part of the political spectrum in the South. He worked closely with President Moon Jae-in, who was somebody who advocated opening and negotiations with the North. So very consistent position for the left. But President Moon has also been taken aback by Kim Jong-un's continued missile tests and, you know, basically bravado in the face of his offer of talks. Nonetheless, Seoul, as you know, is 25 miles south of the demilitarized zone. And there's arsenals of artillery that the North Koreans have been aiming at Seoul since the 1960s. So should any kind of conflict emerge, or especially should it escalate to a major provocation into a major war, Seoul would be targeted by the North. And that's always been the vulnerability for South Korean leaders. They have 25 million people within range of North Korean military. So I think for President Moon, and he said it again yesterday when our Joint Chief of Staff, Dunford, was in Seoul, he said that there is no, he would not accept the initiation of the use of force by the United States implicitly, right, without the permission of his government. In other words, he would protest any type of unilateralism on the part of the United States to use military force. So I think there's a caution in South Korea about our behavior, our being the United States' behavior. They want us to be there to defend and deter aggression, but they are uncomfortable with the tone and the rhetoric, I think, that we see in the last several weeks coming out of Washington.
My guest today is Sheila Smith. She's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We are talking about the simmering tensions between North Korea and the United States. You can join the conversation by calling 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. You can also send us an email at talk@nprnews.org. I suppose one of the gray area, maybe gray area is not the right term, but we don't exactly know what North Korea's nuclear capabilities are. I mean, they have made various claims, but it's hard to know what's going on. I mean, what's your assessment of what's going on, and how worried should people be?
So I'm not a technical expert, and so I'm repeating the expertise of others here when I respond. But we do know several things. One is because we had a process of negotiation with North Korea called the Agreed Framework. It was in the, I think, 1994 to 2002, I believe. We had a framework within which the North Koreans had agreed to shut down the Yongbyon Processing Center for plutonium, right? And we had experts on the ground. We were monitoring. So there's a certain amount of knowledge of how much plutonium they actually had to begin with and how much they then extrapolating how much they could have produced in the meantime, right, from the time that Yongbyon restarted. It was restarted again by the North. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that we're all talking about the military, you know, threats back and forth today, but in fact there's been a two-decade-long process of negotiations here, fits and starts to be sure, but different kinds of negotiations to try to find a workable framework for denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. But in the early phase of this agreed framework approach, the North Koreans did agree to stop their plutonium processing. So we have a base amount from which we can, our technical experts can project. There's also an enriched uranium project that we found out that they were running clandestinely all through this process. And so that the Bush administration put us, you know, basically called them out on. And so we don't know how much of the enriched uranium they may have produced, right, because we have no inspectors. We didn't know about it. So there's a certain amount of the projections of fissile material, anywhere from, you know, 10 bombs to something greater than 20. But there's also this other question of whether they can miniaturize nuclear weapons, and that's the technology that would be required if you were going to put a nuclear warhead on a delivery vehicle, on a missile. And that's a difficult process because you have to make sure the fissile material is stable, and that takes a certain kind of sophistication. We don't know, but 2 weeks ago now, or about 10 days ago, I think the Washington Post broke a story that our Defense Intelligence Agency had basically come to the conclusion that it's most likely that they have, by now, the technology available to miniaturize nuclear weapons. So that puts us in a position now where they both are trying to develop this capacity to reach the United States through an intercontinental ballistic missile. They tested two of those in July. Again, experts watch those flights, watch those missile tests, and try to extrapolate from that what their technical competency is. Some think that the reentry vehicles are still unstable. So that was the test that was done on July 28th. Didn't look like they had control over the missile when it went into the sea, just 80 miles off of Japan. And so that would be an important factor for them to perfect before they could, you know, extend the range of an ICBM to the United States. But this is what we're hearing from our experts, that there is reason to believe that they are much closer to an ICBM capability, an intercontinental ballistic missile capability, which is what would reach the United States, they have reached this point faster than we thought they might. There's some speculation, although it's not confirmed, that they may have had some rocket parts from Russia, from Ukraine. The Russian technology, but it has been exported or it has been purchased from Ukraine, but that is not confirmed. Still in the media at the moment. So there may have been some external help and assistance in the technological side of the missile development program. But nonetheless, here's the issue is for Seoul and Tokyo, they don't need an ICBM, right? They need they only need shorter range missiles. And remember, the United States has forces, about 28,000 U.S. men and women in uniform are in South Korea, and we have around 50,000 in Japan. So if we got into a conflict or if we, again, got into this escalatory path, there are plenty of Americans who are vulnerable to North Korea in the region, not underestimating the impact on the Japanese and South Korean populations themselves.
Mm-hmm. So over the weekend, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and General Duford wrote an opinion column saying that they want a peaceful resolution to the situation with North Korea. And they talked about applying diplomatic and economic pressure on North Korea to achieve denuclearization and a dismantling of the regime's ballistic missile program. Do you think there's any possibility that that might actually happen? And what would it take to have that happen?
Yeah, so there's a lot going on diplomatically. And again, because there's this sort of rhetorical focus on the military capabilities, we're missing another important part of what the Trump administration is doing. You saw very early on Secretary Tillerson and even our Defense Secretary Jim Mattis say that while we need to be ready to defend, and our preparedness, right, our military preparedness is key. We need to be ready here in the region and here at the United States. We are also putting as much pressure as we can on the North Koreans to come back to the table. A Sunday ago, the UN Security Council passed a unanimous resolution, which is unusual, to sanction North Korean economic activity. And it's an important I thought it was an important threshold because we've had many sanctions efforts by the UN before, most of which were tied very specifically to their weapons program. So any materials that were seen to assist them in the development of missiles or obviously that were assisting their nuclear program would be sanctioned, right? Any companies doing business in any of those materials would be sanctioned as well, so non-North Korean companies, right? But what they did in this latest UN resolution, and this is where you see the role of China and Russia shifting, is that they agreed to sanction some of North Korea's major exports,
mm-hmm.
Many of them natural resources, coal, oil, and seafood, right, which is where the North Koreans gain a lot of foreign exchange earnings off of the trade. And this is unusual for two reasons. One is it no longer links specifically to activities on the weapons programs themselves, which China has always insisted that we only approve UN sanctions if they were tied to the weapons program, not if they were just overall economic sanctions. So China has shifted on this, as has Russia. What will be important, of course, in all diplomacy is to see implementation. And for the sanctions regimes in particular, if they are implemented, this is a serious shift in the international community's response to North Korea. The estimates I've seen is about $1 billion worth of trade, and North Korea only has about $3 billion worth of trade. So it would be up to perhaps one-third of the trade earnings of North Korea, which is a significant cut into their ability to take care of their government and their society. So this will hurt, in other words. So sanctions are one of the means of putting pressure. The other is, of course, the military readiness piece of the puzzle, and we've already talked about that, so I won't repeat that. But trying to get North Korea to the table via, you know, our diplomacy with Beijing, even our conversation with Russia. When you saw about a month or a half ago or so, we had the G20 meeting. Now, the G20 meeting has 20 countries. It usually talks about economic issues, not security issues. Mm-hmm. But North Korea was discussed bilaterally by Prime Minister Abe of Japan. President Moon Jae-in of South Korea was talking about it. There was a trilateral meeting with Moon, Abe, and President Trump. So North Korea was in the background of a lot of the major power discussions at the G20. So I think you see now an international community that is much more focused on North Korea than it has been in the past.
Sheila Smith, I'm really sorry. We've actually run out of a little time, but thank you very much. It seems that we will certainly be talking about this for a long, long time in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Sheila Smith is Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us today.